Looking forward to a new season of the PBS hit drama Mercy Street, whose co-creator and executive producer is a Mainer. Mercy Street, the Civil War era drama set in a Union hospital in Alexandria, Virginia, starts its second season next weekend on PBS. The first season was a success, with a total estimated viewership of 14 million people. It was PBS's second most popular drama, behind only Downton Abbey. The series is fictional, but its characters and much of the plot are based on historical figures and historical events. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Main Calling, we get a preview of Season 2 of Mercy Street with its co-creator and executive producer, Lisa Wolfinger, as well as several of the experts advising the producers. Main Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Last year, as the hit TV show Downton Abbey was coming to an end, PBS greenlighted an American drama based during the Civil War and focused on a Union hospital. Well, it appears that PBS executives chose well. Mercy Street was a big hit and enters its second season in a little more than a week. On the line with us now is the show's co-creator and executive producer, Lisa Wolfinger. Joining us from her office at Indiana University is Jane Schultz. She's a professor of English and medical humanities and the director of literature at Indiana University and Purdue University. She is one of the historical advisors to Mercy Street. And also on with the line with us, Anya Jabour. She is professor of history at the University of Montana, and script review and consultant to the executive producers and screenwriters of Mercy Street. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you a fan of the show? What questions do you have about it? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Lisa, congratulations on the second season of Mercy Street. The big question, what can we expect from season two?
The big question. Well, thanks for having me on the air. As you know, this is one of my favorite radio shows. So,
thank you.
It's an exciting season. We've expanded the scope. We go new places. We up the romance factor. We've got spy action, murder, intrigue, some more battle action. It's an exciting season. I mean, I think if season one had a subtitle, it might be Allegiance, since in many ways we explore how our various characters navigate through all sorts of allegiances, whether to country, family, love, even themselves. And I think if season two had a subtitle, it might be Freedom, or at least The Road to Freedom. As the war intensifies, our characters are struggling to liberate themselves from the shackles of bigotry, vengeance, duty, blood, even their own inner demons. And of course, all these smaller narratives of liberation are set against the backdrop of a nation rapidly hurtling towards a more literal and momentous freedom, the end of slavery. So in many ways, we bring the war closer this season and explore how it impacts our characters.
Yeah, I've only seen the first episode of season two, but I can tell already that there's a little more romance in the mix. One of the really... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think it was Stonewall Jackson who first said, "We are bringing sexy back."
One of the really interesting things about Mercy Street is how much work you and the rest of the team put into historical accuracy. Jane, what does it mean to you as an academic to be bringing this kind of history to life for so many people?
Well, it's a thrill, in short, in part because so often we do our work, we publish our books and our articles, and very few of us ever really get to participate in something that's going to be seen by so many people. So in addition to just getting our work out there, perhaps the more important thing is that any ideas that people have about the Civil War that may not be accurate can be in many ways corrected by a program that pays careful attention to the authenticity.
Anya, you're also an expert advisor to the team. Can you tell us about some of the more unusual information requested by the show's creators? What have you been asked to track down? What kind of questions have you been asked to answer?
That is a great question. The entire time I've been working on the show, I'm always ready for an email from Lisa, usually with the subtitle, A Quick Question. And I've answered quick questions for season two on everything from racy French literature to racist language of the 19th century. I've fielded questions about women's horseback riding expertise and about the sort of conditions of life in wartime Richmond. And then on the totally other end of the spectrum, conditions of life in the contraband camps where refugees from slavery gathered. So really pretty much all over the map, I could be asked anything, which is really kind of a fun challenge to say, oh, well, what's it going to be this time?
They're
not actually always quick to answer, but they're always interesting.
Anya and Jane, I'll ask you both this. Do you have anything that you've said to Lisa or some of the other producers? There's this really interesting fact I've stumbled across. I think somehow you'll want to work this into the program.
I can jump in first, if that's all right, and
sure.
Then let Jane pick up. Because I got to be on set during season one, and between shots, there's a fair amount of time for just sort of hanging out. I had the opportunity to talk with Lisa about a lot of ideas, right? Of themes that could be potentially explored further if there were a second season. This, of course, was long before season one aired, so we had no idea if there was a second season. And I think it's fair to say that a couple of those conversations have had an impact on season two in ways that, of course, I can't talk about because of my non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, okay. Well, Jane, is there anything you can disclose?
Well, I can probably go a little more, but Lisa can certainly put the gag order on me if she needs to do that. Just this past summer, when Anya and I were both on the set, though not at the same time for season two, we came up against a situation with one of the new characters who is a British lord. I think it's fair to say that. Is that okay?
Yes,
with
I
us?
Think that's fine.
Thank you, Lisa.
That's fine.
Okay. And we realized that he does talk about some historical issues in his family's background, and we realized that the chronology of what he was talking about was inaccurate. So Lisa set me on this after lunch one day, go back to the trailer and start looking for an appropriate military history for this guy's family. So I looked high and low, and after about an hour, I found something that would fit with his biography. But, that was under time pressure, and I thought, oh, what if I don't find something? But I did finally find something, and that was good.
As a journalist, I can appreciate the time pressure. Lisa, yeah. You have some pretty big name actors appearing in Mercy Street, and I know that they are busy people with other projects. I'm wondering, logistically, how you shoot this series around their other projects, especially because your cast is pretty large.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and it was especially challenging this season. We've been very fortunate in that we can shoot in the spring in Richmond, right after it's a show called Turn that also shoots in Richmond, and they end right around February, so we're able to slide right in. And that's really helped us out with actor schedules because we have quite a few actors who are in returning series on other networks, and of course they shoot through the fall, but they have a hiatus through the late spring, early summer. So it's worked out very well for us. This past season, we actually added some new heavy hitters to our cast, including Patina Miller, who appears on Madam Secretary, has also won a Tony for her work on Broadway, and Bryce Pinkham, who hasn't done a lot of television, but is very well known to Broadway fans, and he's currently the lead in Holiday Inn in New York. So that was just a plug for Bryce's play.
How many episodes in a season, and how long does it take you to shoot them?
Right now we're doing 6 episodes a season, and that again helps us out because it's not a very long time commitment for some of these actors, especially somebody like Gary Cole or Mary Elizabeth Winstead. They're busy actors, so it really works well for their schedule. So season 1, 6 episodes, season 2, 6 episodes. Obviously our hope is that we continue to grow our audience and we can expand the number of episodes because we do have a big cast, and it's very hard to do justice to everybody in the cast with the very little real estate, as we like to call it, that we have. 6 hours is not enough.
Well, as you hinted, there are some new characters this season. I'd like to play a clip from the first episode of season two where we meet one of them. Charlotte Jenkins has just appeared at the hospital.
What precisely do you do?
Educate, support, fortify. It's all there in the letter.
We are most happy to have you.
Well, you are free to move about among them, doing your business.
Something more pressing has come to my attention. You have the makings of an epidemic here. Smallpox. Something isn't done.
Smallpox?
I know it has been a problem in Washington among the Negroes.
Not only Washington, sir, and not only the Negroes. I'd like to establish a quarantine tent outside this hospital.
Bring the smallpox closer.
We'll isolate it to prevent spread.
We have seen typhoid. No smallpox yet. When the disease comes...
It is already here, sir. I've seen signs of it within your own staff.
We do not treat Negro patients.
It is not a Negro disease, sir. The depleted state in which freed people are kept allows the disease to find its hold among them, but it quickly spreads to soldiers, white people, at which point those who would blame the Negroes are quick to say, see what the slaves bring, see what freedom has wrought.
Jane, tell us about Charlotte Jenkins. I understand she is based upon a real person.
Yeah, she's actually a composite character. I see a bit of a couple of characters. One wonderful nurse who left slavery at about age 14 in South Carolina and joined one of the U.S. colored troops. Susie King Taylor was her name, and she published a reminiscence in the early 20th century about her experience. So she was a bit of a factotum in the sense that she not only did nursing work, she knew how to clean and shoot rifles, she took care of the horses, she did laundering work and so forth. So she did a bit of everything in her capacity there. But then she, Charlotte Jenkins, is also based on a character called Charlotte Fortin, a real historical figure named Charlotte Fortin, who was from the famous Fortin Purvis family of the Northeast, Philadelphia. And Charlotte Fortin did her best over the beginning years of the war to try to get a position with the Freedmen's Bureau so that she could, in fact, go south and begin teaching some of the contrabands in military camps. And she was finally successful, but not before she was initially rebuffed by several of those groups saying that, you know, they did not want to hire African-American women to do this work. So she was finally able to make inroads when she talked to the right people, I think. But Charlotte Jenkins is certainly based on these couple of people, if not more.
Yeah, if I could just jump in, because, another big inspiration actually was another real-life character, an ex-slave turned activist, Harriet Jacobs, who actually spent the war years in Alexandria helping contrabands transition to freedom. And she might have been our biggest inspiration, in fact.
Lisa,
yeah, if I could just add.
Yeah, go ahead, Anya.
I was really excited about the Charlotte Jenkins character, in part because of the link to Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs is just such a remarkable figure. She wrote a memoir of her early life, and it's one of those stories that really proves the adage that truth is stranger than fiction. She was taught to read by a kindly mistress when she was young, but then later was inherited by a lustful master and a jealous mistress, and went through all kinds of trials and tribulations. Eventually, she ended up escaping from slavery only by hiding in a garret for 7 years before she finally escaped to freedom. And then, as Lisa suggested, once she regained her health, which had suffered from her, you know, self-imposed incarceration in this attic in order to achieve freedom, she returned south to help other slaves or former slaves in the process of acquiring their freedom. So it's really a remarkable, her story is just one of those really remarkable stories that I think is well known among scholars, but not at all well-known among the general public, so I'm really excited that Charlotte Jenkins is going to bring that story, among others, to a wider public.
Lisa, the
yes,
clip
no,
we
it's
played,
worthy of a yep. feature film.
Yeah, Lisa, the clip we played also introduces something else, which I suspect is going to become part of the plot, which is the introduction of smallpox and then typhoid fever. Is this also taken from historical research in the hospital, the Mansion House Hospital in Alexandria, Virginia, during the Civil War? Was there smallpox?
Yes, the answer is yes. We were inspired by the story of a smallpox epidemic that hit Alexandria in the summer and fall of 1862 and devastated the contraband community at the time. And we knew we wanted to do something with that. We knew we wanted to deal with disease this season because we didn't really touch on disease a whole lot in season one. And, of course, disease was omnipresent and was certainly a major killer during the Civil War. More soldiers died of disease, certainly, than they did of their wounds. So we knew we wanted to tackle it. The smallpox story felt like a good one. It also tied into our Charlotte Jenkins character. It gave her something to do. Beyond the smallpox epidemic, we actually also deal with a typhoid storyline within the hospital.
Just by chance, there were several main regiments that in the winter of 1862, from the fall months on, into 1863, had numerous cases of smallpox. So that was something that was quite prevalent among main regiments that were encamped near Washington at the time.
Mm. Anya, another interesting part of the plot is the Green family dynamics. And the Green family, if you haven't seen the program, is the Confederate family that owns the hotel that has been converted into the hospital, the Union Hospital. As the war and the show progresses, the daughters, Alice and Emma Green, are beginning to take different paths. And this is something that's based on real people, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. The Greens did, in fact, have daughters, and Alice Green, as well as the son, Jimmy Jr., and that gives the show the opportunity to explore the ways in which women, especially young women, were really expanding their roles in the Civil War era. So one of the exciting things about season two, I think, is that we really get to see Alice Green develop more as a character and break out of her familiar role as a Southern Belle and take on new and rather dangerous role in the Civil War. Like other young women, she was sort of propelled both by a need to be useful and by her political allegiances to violate conventional gender norms. And so that's definitely one of the exciting parts of the show for me as a specialist in 19th century U.S. women's history.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We do have to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, offering non-toxic solutions for downsizing and living well in smaller spaces. CondoFurniture.com. And Collin Center for the Arts, presenting An Evening with Pat Metheny, Sunday, January 15th. CollinCenterForTheArts.com.
How many friends do you really have? Even if you count everyone you know or like on Facebook or Instagram, it's probably going to add up to one number.
You've only got 150 slots for friends and family generally. The digital world isn't really going to change that.
How our networks work. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock and again Wednesday evening at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
A spoken poem makes a momentary community between speaker and listener. Hi, this is Stuart Kestenbaum, Maine's Poet Laureate. Join me for Poems From Here, heard weekly on Maine Public Radio after Maine Calling on Friday, or on Maine Public Classical after Robin and Toby's shows. Visit us online at mainepublic.org for our schedule and where you can hear all of our poems from here.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, a preview of Season 2 of Mercy Street. On the line with us, the show's co-creator and executive producer, Lisa Wolfinger. Jane Schultz is also on the line with us. She is a professor of English and medical humanities and the director of literature at Indiana University and Purdue University. She is one of the historical advisors to Mercy Street. And Anya Jabour is also on the line with us. She is a professor of history at the University of Montana and script review and consultant to the executive producers and screenwriters of Mercy Street. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Anya, I understand we were talking about Alice Green a little bit before the break. She's somewhat based on a real 17-year-old spy named Belle Boyd. Tell us about Belle Boyd.
Yes. Well, Belle Boyd, again, is another one of those characters where where you really do not have to look very far for dramatic interest and dramatic intrigue. Belle Boyd was a very well-educated woman, an accomplished equestrian, notorious flirt, and it turned out that she was able to turn all of those skills that had been intended to prepare her for a fashionable debut and a successful courtship and eventually marriage to, you know, a very eligible bachelor, all ended up serving her very well as a spy for the Confederacy. And she served very successfully as a spy, was supposed to have given Stonewall Jackson some very important information in the course of the war. She also took great risks in order to do so, and the creators of Mercy Street definitely seek to incorporate some of those dangers that were attendant upon espionage into the character of Alice Green.
Jane, I think it's so interesting that you are an expert in nursing history. Can you talk a little bit about Mary Finney, the main character in Mercy Street, the head nurse at this hospital, this Union Hospital, and how nursing changed because of the Civil War?
Oh, nursing changes significantly. Before the war, of course, nurses are not usually paid. Some are, but most are not. And people nurse in their homes, not so much outside of their homes. There are class issues involved with that as well. But it's really in its pre-professional era. And as a result of the Civil War, you know, in the later 1860s, as people discuss the medical care of the war, they realize that, like physicians, who, of course, professionalized before the Civil War, that this would make sense to do for women who are the primary nurses in this era. And so nursing begins to professionalize with various schools of nursing where students come in and they actually take care of hospital patients by, you know, 1869, 1870, and mostly in the Northeast. Now, for women like Mary Finney, there are many, many women who came from the Northeast, and it's interesting that much of the written record, that is a sort of primary personal account record of nursing in by Union women, there are many, many women from Maine who actually were part of that. So Maine plays a really central role in having sent a good number of women in all kinds of capacities to do nursing, not only in Maine, but outside of Maine, the Washington, D.C. area, and even some into the Confederacy. So Mary Finney was a fairly typical example. She's a well-educated, fairly straight-laced woman, at least initially we see that. She is certainly beginning to find some interest in Dr. Foster in Season 1, and we see her thinking about it even more in Season 2, but she doesn't quite have conviction yet in this particular way because she still thinks of herself as there to do an important job. So she's really trying to gain credibility for herself and for women more generally in this era. But nursing itself as a profession does not begin to emerge until we start having training schools in the post-Civil War period. And it is primarily this work, much of it domestic work, that women did during the war that that's responsible for the initiative to begin professionalizing nursing.
Anu Jabbour, we have to say goodbye to you, but before we go, I want to ask you, what do you hope the audience comes away with when they watch Mercy Street?
I think the most important thing for me is that I hope that they come away thinking, wow, I never knew history was so interesting and exciting, and I want to know more.
All right. Well, Anu Jabbour, thank you so much for joining us today, professor of history at the University of Montana and script review and consultant to the executive producers and creators of Mercy Street.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to go to our calls now. We're going to go to Rachel, who is calling from Brunswick. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Oh, hi. It's lovely to be on your show. I just wanted to say to the about the program Mercy Street, it's great to see this kind of drama done in the U.S., and it's so historically accurate. As a somewhat semi-retired Civil War reenactor, I just love it when anybody does it right. We always try to be as authentic as possible, even though our cars are parked across the street in the field somewhere, while we're hanging out in our, quote, funny clothes and tents. But I really enjoyed the show enormously. And I love the emphasis that they place on how much disease played a role amongst the battles and the contraband folks that were escaping from behind the lines. And I know that was something we always tried to explain to people. More people died of disease in battle than of actual wounds. In our own family, we had a letter from an ancestor that was in Alexandria during the war, in the early part of the war, 1862, and he was relieved, came home due to medical discharge before he ever saw a shot fired in anger. So I always wondered what it was that he came down with in camp.
Lisa.
Probably dysentery and some other nasty diseases, unfortunately. But it's very heartening to hear you say, you know, you enjoy the show and you certainly know a lot about the history. So that means a lot. Now that we had a screening in Gettysburg last year, and actually we have another one coming up tomorrow. But we had a screening last year for season one. And I confess I was a little nervous because, you know, it's kind of the heart, if you will, the heartland for Civil War historians or amateur historians, Civil War buffs. And the screening went incredibly well. I mean, everybody loved it. And we actually had reenactors sitting in the audience. They completely embraced it. And I only had one critique, and somebody complained about one button that they thought was incorrect. We then went back and checked, and in fact, we were correct. But that was it, just one criticism about a button. So I felt that that was a triumph.
Lisa, were the Civil War reenactors wearing their uniforms when they watched the film at the screening?
Yes, some of them.
Oh, my.
Absolutely. We had a fife and drum band. It was very exciting.
Rachel, thank you so much for calling. We're joined now by Shauna Devine, who is an assistant professor in the Department of History of Medicine at Western University. And Shauna, thanks for joining us today. Tell me about your role in Mercy Street.
Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I first became involved in the project when the producer, Lisa Wolfinger, who's there. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there.
Called me just before my book was going to come out in early 2014. And she had done quite a lot of reading of the extant secondary and primary source literature. And she had sort of realized that the historiography was starting to change. It was within the last 10 or 15 years, historians and doctors have started to coalesce around a new idea about the Civil War medicine, that it was not, in fact, a medical disaster in which, you know, doctors were just senselessly hacking off limbs and spreading disease. We can actually trace the origins of modern medicine in America to this period in medical history. And Lisa had had been reading books, and she was talking about this, and she saw mine, and that's really the subject of my book. And so she contacted me, and I came on as a historical advisor shortly after.
Great.
And my role is generally, I'm in the archives. I'm currently working on a second book, and based on that and my research from my first book, I actually go to the doctor's case books, and a lot of them are unpublished, so they're manuscript sources, handwritten case books, and, you know, I'll give those exact cases I'll suggest them to Lisa and to the writers of Mercy Street. And so many of the medical cases that you see in the show and depicted in the show are actually drawn from the actual case histories of doctors that
work in the hospitals. Neat. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run a very short clip, and then we'll talk about that. This is from Season 2, Episode 1.
I need some tubing, some needles, and a glass cup.
How intriguing. What does it do?
Transfers blood from a healthy person in order to compensate for exsanguination. Blundell calls it a transfusion.
Oh, my.
Why me, Foster?
You're healthy. Got good veins.
Oh. It is most bizarre.
Okay, is that what you're talking about, Shauna, a blood transfusion?
That's one in particular, and that's such a fascinating scene because I have people all the time saying, no, they weren't attempting blood transfusions during the American Civil War, and the blood program during Vietnam, in which blood transfusions became sort of a standard part of the triage and emergency medical process, it's well known, and it was life-saving changes. But, I mean, it actually goes back much further, all the way back to the early 17th century when William Harvey discovered the circulation of the blood. And physicians, very elite physicians, experimental-minded, would sort of talk about what kind of possibilities might there be in cases of trauma for blood transfusions. And it doesn't go anywhere. But in the Civil War, it does. There's actually a discussion about the efficacy of blood transfusions, the possibility of doing them. And it goes so far as to 1864, where Joseph Barnes in the Army Medical Museum actually posits the possibility of making this part of required emergency treatment and including it to triage, but it's just too new and too complicated. So other than a few experimental procedures and some done with animals in the Army Medical Museum, it doesn't take root. But you see the origins of this modern application of this procedure. And that's what's so great about Mercy Street, is it's bringing some of the really unique aspects of Civil War medicine to the public consciousness.
I'm going to read an email from Jeff. Family lore placed my great-great-great-grandfather, David Hall, who served as a medical man, perhaps a doctor, at a Union prison. But he himself was imprisoned for treating the Southern prisoners too well. He came back to the Monmouth area and died of tuberculosis. He contracted while imprisoned. So the story goes. Boy, Lisa, it sounds like a story that could be right out of your out of Mercy Street on many levels.
Well, that's a fabulous story. Actually, Shauna should jump in because she's been researching the medical story of the South as well recently.
But it's interesting that he, you know, there's some discussion about how to treat Southerners but go ahead, Shauna.
Well, there was an idea, a long-held idea, that was just starting to be disputed by some of the medical elite, that there was a certain regional distinctiveness in medicine and how the body was understood. And again, the Civil War becomes sort of a revolutionary time for physicians because they can see that, you know, there is no distinctiveness between northern and southern bodies. There might be southern diseases, pellagra and malaria and yellow fever diseases that seem to be predominant within that region. But ideas about the distinctiveness of the body start to change. And this is just based on the same way that northern doctors are doing autopsies, southern doctors are as well, just on a much smaller scale. And they're faced with shortages and a lack of institutional support to develop these ideas. But among physicians themselves, ideas start to change. And there was that tension between some doctors and their patients. If you had a northern doctor called to treat southern bodies and patients, you see in some sources, but I would argue very rarely, much more rare than other sources in which doctors, and so there's some resistance to treating doctors. I think you see that resistance play out much more among nurses who actually have sons and husbands fighting on the front lines, and they feel resentful towards the patients. This is in some cases. But I think with the doctors, there's still a fraternity among physicians. Many of them had studied together overseas or in medical school prior to the war, and there was still the idea that it was a moral responsibility to treat all patients, regardless of where they were fighting or where they were born. But you do have cases where doctors just did not want to treat soldiers. So there's a couple of interesting ideas there. Ideas about the nature of disease and medicine changes between regionalism and between patients and doctors. Mm-hmm. And then you have these political stories taking shape as well.
All right. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. We have to take another short break. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Ocean View at Falmouth, proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow beginning at 1 p.m. on Maine Public Classical.
Federal policy changes were supposed to end random deportations of people who aren't serious criminals. But in parts of New England, it's still happening.
Era Jose.
They asked me if my name was Jose, and I said, yes, I am. Well, we are ICE agents. We are here to arrest you. And then he handcuffed me and took me to his car.
We'll hear from Vermont farm workers and also hear how Boston police are enforcing that city's pro-immigrant Trust Act. Join us for next from the New England News Collaborative.
That's coming up this afternoon in 20 minutes, just after Maine Calling, here on Maine Public Radio. Are you or someone you know interested in a paid broadcast-related internship position this summer? Maine Public has two positions for college or technical school students interested in careers in the news, journalism, digital news, and/or technical broadcasting fields. Candidates should preferably be attending an institution based in Maine and must have an existing connection to the state of Maine. Application deadline is now January 27th. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and click on About. Or contact us at 207-330-4506.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Mercy Street returns for a second season. On the line with us, the show's co-creator and executive producer, Lisa Wolfinger. Jane Schultz is also on the line with us. She is a professor of English and medical humanities and the director of literature at Indiana University and Purdue University. She's one of the historical advisors to Mercy Street. Shauna Devine is an assistant professor in the Department of History of Medicine at Western University. Join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I want to bring you up to date on programming as well. The season premiere of Mercy Street is Sunday, January 22nd, but Maine Public Television is bringing you the first season this weekend and next weekend. So from Sunday to 2 to 4, both this Sunday and next Sunday, you can watch programs and catch up. And then once the season starts, it will be on Sunday at 8, repeating the following Sunday afternoon at 3. And if that was all confusing for you, you can go to mainepublic.org and it's all right there on our schedule. I'm going to go to Heidi, who's calling from Southern Maine. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Hi. Good to talk with you again, Lisa. It's been wonderful seeing you at the Maine Film and Video Associations. You could probably tell I've got a little bit of under the weather here.
Oh, but, dear.
and I did want to tell you that I've been dealing with a close friend of the family that's going through before I get to my main question, and sorry, I'm a little foggy brain, but have been going through a surgery and a stroke, and I see how watching Mercy Street again has that much more impact on me in terms of being able to see what's gone on with the how much I appreciate what they didn't have back then to work with and how much they did know too and what the advances and to have more appreciation for what we do have today. And also, my real question is did you see the election coming with all of this and see how much watching Mercy Street would help inform people about the historic roots of where all of this us versus them stuff is coming and the ramifications in today's politics?
No, that's a good question. And I'm sorry you feel bad. Do feel better soon. You know, what's interesting about this is that I was inspired by the history, by the stories of these doctors and nurses and, you know, who were in so many ways the unsung heroes of the war. And as we were pulled into it and realized that there were all these different themes inherent in the material, we just got excited and started to create our storylines and our characters and wove it all together. But no, we certainly didn't sit there with any kind of prescience about what was happening in terms of the election and politics in the country. At this point, you know, from our vantage point here post-election, it's a little uncanny, actually. I mean, I feel like many of the stories we tell in Mercy Street have tremendous relevance today. And that was not a conscious decision on our part at all. It just so happens that much of what we deal with today, much of the divisive politics, really climaxed back in, you know, the 1861, 1862, 3, 4, 5, you know, during the war, and literally tore the country apart. And it hasn't been that long, 150 years roughly, and we can see the scars, and many of those wounds haven't entirely healed. So we are definitely dealing with the aftermath of the Civil War in so many ways, and there's so many issues that have not been resolved, unfortunately.
Interestingly, this is Jane Schultz. I've thought many times, really not even with regard to Mercy Street, but just in a general context, that the United States has felt, particularly during the last four or five years and during the election season, very much like I think Americans perceive the 1850s as the sectional conflict really heated up. And we seem to be reliving that again, you know, 150 years later. It's just a little bizarre.
Heidi, thank you so much for your question. We have an email from Beattie. Has Mercy Street considered bringing in Walt Whitman's nursing during the Civil War? Plus, he was, I believe, gay, which is of interest, too. Lisa, have we thought about Walt Whitman?
Oh, goodness, yes. We have a Walt Whitman storyline ready to go. We wanted to put it into season two, but we're very disciplined about sticking to historical timeline, and it just didn't fit because our timeline in season two begins right where we left off. So the day the Lincolns visited the hospital and proceeds through the summer and fall of 1862, we actually take it all the way to around September 22nd in the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. And of course, Walt Whitman didn't begin his career as a male, I don't want to say nurse, certainly volunteer nurse, until January, certainly the winter of 1863. So we had to wait. But we do have a storyline ready to go for season three. And in fact, somebody just came up to me with a really interesting story. He works at the library. And I can never get this right, but maybe Shauna can help me. The library for the National Library that houses all of our medical archives in Washington, D.C.
The National Museum of Health and Medicine.
Thank you. Anyway, we were talking yesterday, and it turns out they have four specimens from four different, I guess, people, skeletons, and they've been able to trace them directly to Walt Whitman. Apparently, these were four patients that Walt Whitman took care of and wrote letters for them back to their loved ones. And they were also able to find the actual case reports for each one of those patients. So it's a really remarkable story, and I'm really looking forward to pulling from one of those patient cases and one of those stories for our Walt Whitman storyline. But yes, we're very excited to tackle Walt Whitman in the next season.
Shauna, go ahead.
Just to jump in, that's where I did the National Museum of Health and Medicine is where I did a big bulk of the research for my book and looked at those specimens and looked at those case histories. And for anybody, any of these people listening, if anybody's sort of thinking about developing a research project on the Civil War, I would highly recommend going there. People tend to rely on the medical and surgical history of the war, the big, you know, huge six-volume encyclopedic history of the war. But much of the dynamism that sort of characterizes these case histories and discussion of specimens never really made it in to that. I mean, they're heavily edited out. So if you go in and into that collection that Lisa's referring to and look at those long case histories, Walt Whitman's case histories included, it's a fascinating and very revealing way to really understand sort of the medical impact and the way in which physicians saw these 4 years as an opportunity to build on knowledge, develop knowledge, and then disseminate this knowledge into American medicine. And it's just fascinating.
Jane, I want to get back to disease a little bit. I'm feeling torn because I've seen the first episode. But let's just say that it's not only the patients who get these diseases. Was it common for people who worked in the hospitals in the Civil War to also to succumb to diseases?
Yes, it was. We have to remember, of course, that physicians were only beginning to understand the germ theory, and it was not widely embraced until after the Civil War. So not enough was known about pathogens. And as Charlotte Jenkins says in that first episode of the new season, smallpox was going to be just as effective on white bodies as on black. And we can certainly transfer that to the idea that any sickness, whether it be typhoid, smallpox, diphtheria, various types of pneumonia, all of these things were diseases that were caught by staff, by physicians, by nurses, by people doing laundering work in the hospitals and so forth. The hospitals, of course, had many more staff people in them than just physicians and nurses. Sometimes they had male nurses as well as female ones. Ward masters like Silas Bullen in the steward Silas Bullen in Mercy Street, and people got sick all the time, and it was not unusual. In fact, Walt Whitman writes about one such woman who is a nurse and who dies during her service and receives a military burial in Washington after she dies. But many listeners may be familiar with the story of Louise May Alcott, who went from her home in Massachusetts to nurse soldiers in Union Hotel Hospital in Washington, Georgetown section of Washington. And she'd only been there, I want to say, about 5 to 6 weeks when she caught typhoid. And the matron in charge of that hospital, a woman called Hannah Ropes, who ultimately published a narrative about her experience and ultimately died herself of typhoid, sends Alcott home with her father because they don't want for young women who are actually doing this volunteer work to die in the hospital. So even though Hannah Rope sends Louisa May Alcott home, and Alcott, of course, recovers after having been treated with calomel, a mercury derivative, you know, from which she suffered for much of the rest of her life, Ropes herself succumbed to the disease. She had nowhere where to go and stayed in the hospital and died of it. So we have a number of not only anecdotal examples like this one, but, you know, again, the documents at the National Archives or the National Library of Medicine are filled with such examples.
All right. Well,
just very quickly to jump in,
what's really remarkable is that Louisa May Alcott wrote most of the books that she is now famous for, including Little Women, during that long convalescence when she was feeling terrible. And, you know, to think of her huddled over her little desk writing all day long, and she trained herself to write first with the right hand, then the left hand, just so she could keep writing. It's just amazing to me.
So many interesting little stories. Thank you all so much for being here on Maine Calling. And congratulations, Lisa, on a second season of Mercy Street. Lisa Wolfinger, the co-creator and executive producer of Mercy Street. Jane Schultz, professor of English and medical humanities and the director of literature at Indiana University and Purdue University. She's one of the historical advisors to Mercy Street. And Shauna Devine, an assistant professor in the Department of History of Medicine at Western University. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. We had additional help from John Bradford. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.